for talking with me today, and it's always a pleasure, both on and off the radio.
It is a treat. I so much appreciate what you do on this show, and, you know, speaking as, like I said, a word woman, a book person. Great. Thanks a lot, Ken.
We've been talking with Judith Arcana, author of the new story collection, Hello, This is Jane, published by Oregon's Left Fork Press. You can find out more about the new book online at juditharcana.com. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KABU Community Radio. Many thanks to Judith for visiting us at KABU, and to all of you for listening.
Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm S.W. Conser. Linda Barry is a grande dame of American comics. Her weekly strip Ernie Pook's Comique ran for nearly 30 years in alternative newspapers and led to numerous illustrated novels, including The Good Times Are Killing Me, which was adapted for the stage in 1990. Barry became a mentor to young and not-so-young creatives with her how-to books What It Is, Picture This, and Syllabus, Notes from an Accidental Professor. Her writing workshops have been popular throughout the U.S. and Canada. She now makes her home near Madison, where she is the Associate Professor of Interdisciplinary Creativity at the University of Wisconsin, and a recipient of a 2019 MacArthur Genius Grant. And now, Linda Barry, recorded at Powell's City of Books in Portland, October 14th, 2019.
Extremely fortunate to host one of the most accomplished and legendary graphic novelists of all time here at the store. Linda Barry's amazing career as an all-around artist, commentator, teacher, and author has garnered her an Eisner Award and the R.R. Donnelly Award. Her Ernie Pooks and Marlis comics are two of the most recognizable and wonderful examples of how to tell stories in comics. And her most recent book on creativity, her most recent books, What It Is, Picture This, and Syllabus are bestsellers that are wildly adored by readers. Her new book, Making Comics, comes out on November 5th. We're excited to welcome Linda Barry.
So, Making Comics. This is my new book, and it's kind of a recipe book for how I run my class at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And I wrote it like a recipe book, so reading a recipe book wouldn't be that fun. So I'm going to try to do the best I can to read the text that's there, but show you pictures that aren't. Let's just put it that way. My students have accused me of loving f***ed up drawings with all my heart, and I have to say that is true. That this book is a recipe book for those of you who gave up on drawing a long time ago, who would like to give it another try. So I could look at this drawing all day long. You know, so good. All right. So most people who stopped drawing, gave up drawing at about the age of 8 or 9 when they realized they couldn't draw a nose, right? A nose or hands, right? It's like, well, you're washed up at 8 or 9. It's kind of But the cool thing about comics is comics leaps right over that problem. If you think of Bart Simpson or Charlie Brown with a hyper-realistic nose and hyper-realistic hands, that'd be horrible, right? Kathy would look all right. But there's something about comics that has that requires such small little marks. I'm going to talk a little bit about that. All right. There was a time when drawing and writing were not separated for you. In fact, our ability to write could only come from our willingness and inclination to draw. In the beginning, we drew the letters of our name. The motions hadn't become automatic enough yet to call it writing. I work with 4-year-olds at the University of Wisconsin-Madison along with my students, so this is those are my co-researchers who provided the visuals for this part of the talk. There was a lot of variability of shape, order, orientation, and even the mood of the letters. The kid who drew this, whose name was Ella, said, "Look at this big E bossing all the other letters." The letters were characters, and when certain characters got together in a certain order. So talent, who has it? How old do you have to be to make a bad drawing? There is a certain kind of drawing that I adore. It shows up on the first day of class when I ask students to spend 3 minutes drawing themselves as an astronaut. And then I ask them to draw themselves as some kind of animal. It's the line of someone who quit drawing a long time ago. And then I ask them to draw themselves turning a little bit into a fruit or vegetable.
Don't you want to try it? Like immediately?
One of the things I do when I say you're going to draw yourself turning into a bit of a fruit or a vegetable, they look at me like this and I go, "No bananas." And they're like, "Aw." The line is unpracticed and a little bit out of the person's control. But it has a kind of aliveness that is impossible to fake and difficult to copy, like the handwriting and drawing of very little kids. So I get to work with all these different kids, and then they draw, and I ask them about their drawings. When very young kids draw, there's always some sort of story that comes with it. This is what the girl told me about this drawing. 100 years ago, there were nice wolves and little red riding hood lived in a tree, and the sun was black and the moon was black, but there's no more black, so I used purple. I had this one drawing, I wish I had a copy of it, but it was this little girl, and it looked like a beach scene, and there were two suns, and there was all this red, and there was this ocean, and I said, "So what's going on here?" She goes, "Well, obviously it's a shark that killed someone." What? But then this other adult in the room is really uptight, comes over and goes, "Tell me about your drawing." And she looked at the woman, and she goes, "It's a beautiful sunset." When I work with little kids, I draw alongside them. Sometimes I copy them. I don't say much about drawing. I'm not there as a teacher, although I will help them spell out the words they need. So you can see they wanted to draw the Harry Potter stuff, but the one word they didn't want to write was Voldemort, which I thought was kind of smart, and somehow I ended up writing it, so I don't know if he's going to find me. To me, it's a language immersion class. Kids speak image. Kids are fluid in a way that allows me a new understanding about a certain state of mind that twins itself with certain activities. It's something I can't learn by talking theory or talking in general. This is a different sort of language. This is a language that moves up through your hand and into your head. This language is what I'm trying to teach in my comics class. So I want to talk about these, the original digital devices. Here they are. Check them out. Wireless, biofuel, you get to. This is one of the co-researchers I work with who's three. These are on a cave in Australia. I think they're 30,000 years old. And this image of human hands seems to follow us wherever we go. It's this really interesting image. And also the image of an eye in the hand is something that appears over and over in different cultures. So in Jewish culture, it's the hand of Miriam. For Arabs, it's the hand of Fatima. For Catholics, it's the hand of Mary, who had an early version of Illustrator or Photoshop. You see it in science fiction. There's Guillermo del Toro's The Pale Man. And I think there's something really interesting about the hand, and that the more I do research on this whole thing of comics and drawing, I keep coming back to this. When I was a little girl, my mom wasn't that crazy about babies or people in general, but I was born in 1956, and in 1956, one of the common gifts that a mother got was a baby book. So it was this book in pastels, pink or blue, and you were supposed to write the baby's milestones and put in a snippet of their hair and the little handprints. So my mom somebody gave her one, and the only thing that was in that was my name in somebody else's handwriting. But I used to look at it and try to imagine what she would have written if she had been interested. And there were these milestones, and I was probably about 8, and I could read, and one of the milestones was baby discovers own hand. And I remember going, what a stupid baby, right? let's take a look at what that looks like. I'd say that not only is the baby discovering its hand, but the hand is discovering the baby. The hand is discovering that there's somebody who's interested. And to me, that's a really good picture of sort of the two selves that all of us contain, and that we start to realize it. It happens very early on that these two selves start to show themselves, and one is in the hand, and the other is in the attachment to an object or characters. So you've met babies that have a blankie, that fall in love with that blankie. What's interesting is I always think of that as the first artwork, because it really is a piece of cloth. It also suddenly contains this character that has everything to do with that child's well-being. And one of the things I love about comics is we're all born into a world where maybe our families aren't the most wonderful places to be, but we're born into a world that's filled with characters that we can become attached to. And we become attached to the characters that we need, and no one teaches us how to do this. And comic characters are ones that we become especially attached to early on. Let's see what's happening here. So drawing, so people, when they find out I can draw, or until they say, you're a cartoonist? And I say, yeah, and they go, draw something. So I draw something and show it to them, and then they look at me like, you follow that dream. Everyone has a dream, and that's yours.
You're listening to Words and Pictures, recorded at Powell's City of Books in October of 2019, and featuring cartoonist, playwright, author, academic, and MacArthur Genius Grant recipient Linda Barry.
But when people tell me how much they wish they could draw, they say, I can see it in my head, but I can't draw it. And what I tell them is, because what you're seeing in your head isn't a drawing. What you're seeing in your head is something, but it's not a drawing. A drawing is a record of how a person's hand moved in time. So I'm really interested in handwriting, and especially the fact that it's gone. I have my first students who cannot read cursive, you know, because they didn't learn it, they can't read it. And that handwriting and hand motion seems to be disappearing. It's gone from the humanities, it's gone from the arts. The one place that I found at the university where it was still alive was in the sciences. So I work in this building with a lot of scientists. And one of the things that kills me is every possible surface that could be written on is written on. This is written on two sides of glass. And I watch them working and then standing and looking at stuff and the way that they move. And at the same time, I was asked by the university to do some report on what I thought, or what people thought school would be like in 100 years. But they didn't tell me I had to talk to university students, so I went to kids right away because they're more interesting. And one of the kids, but I learned you have to really phrase your question correctly. You can't go, what's school going to be like in 100 years? I know, yes. Really old. So one of these kids, I said, let's draw a picture and then tell me about your picture. So I said, okay. He goes, okay, in the future, school will be pink and orange. And I said, all right. So I took this picture home and then I looked. Check it out. It says, built in 1930, disappeared 1950.
I don't know what the hell that is. But it scared the hell out of me. And then look at the dude in the window, right?
This was the first drawing that made me go, there's stuff going on in these drawings that I have no idea about, and I wouldn't know unless I really started talking to the kids. And all of a sudden, I started to think about how many people say, my drawing looks like a four-year-old did. And what if that's what a line naturally looks like when we're getting an idea? What if it's not that it's a bad drawing, but it's the way your hand moves when you're getting an idea? Or what if that's the way a drawing looks when the drawing is giving us an idea? And that's when I got interested in seeing if I could. I was most interested in working with people who gave up on drawing a long, long time ago. So another thing I like to have my students do is, and this is again with the eye and the hand, and I challenge you to do this for fun. I have them close their eyes, and in 1 minute, they have to draw something with their eyes closed. So I usually have them draw bacon and eggs breakfast. Then there's another exercise that I love to do that everybody seems to be able to do, which is you take a scribble on a piece of paper, and then you pass it to your neighbor, and they have 2 minutes to turn it into a monster. So that's what you end up with a page. That's 4 minutes worth of drawing. And then I have them do this exercise where I say you have to pick a monster, and then you have to copy that monster on your page. Then you have to draw that monster's parents. Which two monsters had to get together to make that? Everybody seems to be able to do it. And then I say, draw, then the next panel is you have to draw that monster as a toddler with an older sibling. Everyone in class seems able to do it. And in fact, the people who haven't drawn in the longest time tend to have the most original stuff. And then the last one I tell them is, I said, so now you're a monster, you've met them in the prime of their life, you've met their parents, you met their kids, met them as kids. I said, now your monster is dead. And they're like, what? and I said, you have to draw the monster at its funeral, and then with some mourners. And everybody's very upset about this, even though it's a squiggle monster. And then I say, let's turn it into a comic. There's that monster. So they copy it, and I said, now I want you to give that monster your middle name. My name is Jane. And the parents, they have to be your parents' name and where they met. Gilbert, my good parents are Gilbert and Marjorie, and they met in high school. When I was little, I loved ice cream cones. I just have them do an anecdote. And then earlier, I had them write the name of a song that they really liked in middle school. I had them write it on an index card. So then I tell them, flip the index card over. This is the funeral scene. And at my funeral, please play 76. There it is. There's her 76. Oh, this person was 76 years old who did this. Who was just, I don't know how to draw. So here I am with my co-researchers in my time of happiness. This is me with my first cousins. I'm the only one with Norwegian blood. I don't have that much Norwegian in me, but you know that Norwegian blood can suck the color out of anything. There it is. And this person there in red is my grandmother, who is a huge influence and was from an area in the Philippines called Iloilo. And I was raised with the Iloilo School of Child Rearing, which was story-based. For instance, she'd say, you know, Linda, on the day that you were born, God made a castle for you in heaven. It's beautiful. It's made of gold bricks. It's so lovely for when you die, you'll have a beautiful place. But every time you are bad, it takes one break. And your castle is getting very, very small. Or she'd tell me, we'd be watching TV, you know, she loved horror movies, and so did I. We were watching Dracula one time. She don't need this white vampire. He's not very special. You know, in the Philippines, we have a very strong vampire. During the day, she's a dog. But at night, it's called the Aswan, at night, she turns into a beautiful woman. And she takes her legs off, and we're like, wait. She takes her legs off, yeah, she takes them off. And then she's flying, Linda, she's flying through the air. She's flying to our house. You know, sometimes we watch the TV and the picture is jumping. And you know, when you go to sleep, she comes in the house. And she likes to crawl in the ceiling. So she's crawling around all over. But she's looking for your bedroom, Linda. And she crawls into your bedroom. She's on the ceiling. And you know, she gets above your bed. And she can turn her head to look down at you. And she has a long tongue. A needle to put in you to stop your blood because you don't pick up your clothes. That's who I grew up. All right. When I was little, I had an uncle who was beginning to show signs of a mental disturbance. He was just out of his teens. He was new to the U.S.
living with a lot of relatives who had come over from the Philippines. He was my mother's half-brother, born during the Japanese occupation in World War II. I have no idea who his father was. While my grandma and his kids were, when her kids were in hiding, he just sort of came about. He was shy, sweet, strange. The first sign of his illness seemed like a superpower. He drew nonstop. He drew on everything. I sat with him often and watched the drawings happen, the people with low hats, so many of them, and you couldn't see their eyes. This drawing came about during an exercise that anyone can do. Four-year-olds, grown-ups, people who gave up on drawing a long time ago, you just make a scribble and you turn it into a monster. That's it? That's exactly it. Let's do it. Suddenly, there it is. Where did it come from? No one could have planned this guy. He just sort of showed up. Now what? In the early days, I could have played this game with my uncle, and I think we would have had a blast before the eyes became too much, too alive. Something about drawing does become too much for people. It's more than just feeling ashamed, it's fear. There's an urge to destroy the drawing and to snatch it and ball it up and toss it. I've rescued so many drawings from the trash can. You're looking at some of them. What was it that horrified their maker so completely? What was the intolerable message? What news? For my uncle, the drawing stopped, and instead he began writing tickets and issuing them as if he were a cop. All my uncles and aunts got them. My grandma got a couple. And then some people on the street, and eventually the real cops were at the door. And this kept happening until he was taken away. He never came back. I never saw him again. And God, I love to watch him draw. It takes about 2 or 3 minutes to make a scribble monster. It takes years to put two and two together. What if your monsters had something to offer you? An unsuspected something? At some point, this monster got out of someone's pen, got out of hand, but here he is again, after being thrown away. In the bin and out of the bin, and homeless. And then in a halfway house you didn't even know existed, although it was just right around the corner, literally a 10-minute walk from your door. Your uncle died there. When you are drawing monsters, have mercy. Have mercy on the unspeakable monster who has no other way to tell you it's you. So when I got to the university, I went to a hippie school, and I, Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. I always say my entrance essay was index card, Elmer's glue, peace sign, lentils, full scholarship. And I only have a BA from there, so when I started teaching at the UW, and I'm a full professor, tenured at the university. No sense. The only thing my CV should say is, she came in through the bathroom. I ended up having grad students, and I had never been around them before, and I didn't understand why they were so miserable. There was misery around a lot of students, but grad students in particular were really, really miserable. And I wondered why this was. They're at the top of their game. They're really, really smart. They're so dedicated to this thing they want to study. And why is their misery acceptable to the academy? Why is that an acceptable state? So I tried to think about what I could do for them. This is my lab. I had a lab at the UW. I got it the same way through the bathroom window. I put on a lab coat, just started walking around in that room a lot. And anytime anyone came over, they had to put on a lab coat too. And then I hung a sign on the door, and it became my lab for 5 years. So I told them that I was going to find co-researchers for them that would be dedicated co-researchers. To help them work on their dissertations and on their thesis every Monday for 2.5 hours, that I had picked special ones out for them. I didn't tell them their co-researchers were four. So I started this program. And one of the things that it did right away, there were a lot of really interesting things that happened while they worked with these co-researchers. But the most important thing that happened was that laser focus that happens when you're in grad school or that you're studying, where you really feel that the rest of the world isn't as important as getting this one paragraph right. The world opened up for them again. And they, you know, at first they would try to explain their dissertations to these kids. And one says, I'm a mathematician.
dissertation, and you know, I'm writing a dissertation on the nature of numbers. And the kid's like, what do you mean? He goes, well, for example, what's four? And so the kid goes, I'm four. And the other kid goes, you are not four. I hate when people say they're four. You are 4 years old. Four is, and so,
wonderful things that happened there. But the other thing that happened was I got them to start to listen to how kids told stories, and to be able to write down, to do the writing for the story. So this is a little story called The Head Falls Off. There was a zombie walking. He walked to a school. He sat on a desk, and then his head fell off. And then he walked out of the school, and his head kept falling off over and over again. And then he got run over by a truck, and his back was bent the whole rest of his life. There's something about the way kids tell stories that I love so much. They have in the same way with their drawings have this natural, satisfying quality, their stories do too. And I was sitting on an airplane once, and there was a kid right next to me. His mom was on her device. She was just gone. But this kid was about 8 years old. He was sitting next to me. And I can't just say to a kid, do you want to talk about transitional objects? So I try to find a way to talk to them, and what I do is I start drawing. So I was drawing this picture kind of big, and he looks over and he goes, you draw? And I go, yeah, I'm a cartoonist. And he goes, draw something for me. So I draw a chicken, and I show him, he goes, you are? I go, no. And I told him, there's this game that we can play. Nobody invented it, but you make a scribble, and then you turn it into something, and then you make a scribble, and I'll turn it into something. And if you do this with the kid three or four passes, you're going to get a story. Three or four passes, and suddenly he goes, ooh, I have a story, and you can make it into a comic strip. Yeah. Now, that's what I always thought creative inspiration looked like. Ooh, I have a novel. It's a trilogy. But this kid's name was Jack, and he goes, and the title, and he didn't even know what the story was. He goes, the title is Chicken Attack by Jack. And this is the story verbatim. I did make it into a comic strip. One morning, a chicken was eaten by a man. The man went to work. His stomach started to feel funny. He went to the portalet, and then he went. The chicken came out. The man was surprised. The chicken was also surprised. The chicken ran from the portalet to the construction site. They put the chicken in charge, and from then on, the chicken was boss. Right? Don't you feel like, yeah, man? It's odd, but it is really oddly satisfying. So as we're leaving, his mom's in front. She's trapped. She hasn't even talked to me at all, but we're waiting to get out, and I tap her on the shoulder, and I say, your son's a really good storyteller. I'm a cartoonist. He told me this story, and I'm going to make it into a comic strip. She goes, yeah? I go, yeah. So I read it to her, and when I finished, then on the chicken was boss, she looked at me, she looked at him, and went, enough with the portalettes. That's what I hear when my students look at these drawings that are wild as hell, and they'll go, I don't like the eye. There was a beautiful thing that my teacher at Evergreen one time said to me when I was looking at this drawing, and I said, I don't know how I feel about this drawing. I don't like it very much, but I don't know how I feel. And she went, it's none of your business. I had a grad student, a PhD student, who had a lot of problems with her advisor and her co-researcher. All she wanted to do was get together and make little fold-up books, and the girl wanted to just write the word no on every page. And my student said, it's the most relieving hour and a half of my day. Just no, no. And then this is the day when she wanted a little tiny book to write yes, but she wanted it to be very, very small. So, that's my talk. Thanks so much for coming.
You've been listening to an episode of Words and Pictures, recorded at Powell's City of Books in October of 2019, and featuring cartoonist, playwright, author, academic, and MacArthur Genius Grant recipient Linda Barry. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. I'm SW Conser. You can find an archived version of the show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures, and be sure to follow us on Twitter. at Words and Picture.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Salem Progressive Film Series presentation of The Long and Twisted Tale of Jordan Cove, LNG. This slideshow depicts part two of Barbara Bernstein's radio documentary series, Holding the Thin Green Line, which explores what is at stake in Southern Oregon if the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal and Pacific Connected Gas Pipeline get built. From July 27th to the 31st, this slideshow video can be viewed at your own convenience at holdingthethingreenline.org/Jordan Cove Slideshow. Then on July 31st from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m., we'll hold a live Q&A session with impacted landowners, community organizers, and land and water protectors who are featured in the documentary. Again, that's The Long and Twisted Tale of Jordan Cove LNG documentary slideshow screening, July 27th to the 31st, and a live on Zoom Q&A on July 31st. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.